Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, April 24, 2018. A young South Sudanese activist says he has the courage to work for change in his country.
The good news is finally the young South Sudanese have realized that they are only being used by the politicians as a means to achieve their own political ambitions. And when we understand that, we will be working so hard even to change our own mindset as a young South Sudanese.
And the ICRC suspends operations in former Unity State after an attack on its compound.
We had to postpone the ongoing distributions of seeds and farming tools that was going on at the moment when this happened. This was a distribution meant to benefit 24,600 people.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A South Sudanese civil society activist is in New York to attend a discussion on how young people can contribute to peace building in fragile states like South Sudan. Malwal Bolkir is the co-founder of the Africa Youth Network, a local civil society group operating in South Sudan. Bol says the meeting has given him the courage to mobilize young people for change in South Sudan. He says the majority of young people in his country are not able to question their leaders. Bol says that mentality has to change.
I'm in New York to attend the opening debate for the UN Security Council on progress study on youth peace and security.
You're talking about opening debate. What is it? Can you explain it to some of us who are not with the UN? We don't understand these terms.
The progress study was mandated by the UN Security Council in 2015. After they adopting the first ever resolution, which recognizes the significant role of young people in the promotion and maintenance of international peace and security. And in 2015, the UN Security Council mandated the UN Secretary General to carry out a progress study to bring out the positive contributions of young people in the promotions of peace and in conflict resolutions. And that report was finalized in February, and it was presented to the Security Council yesterday. So they had a debate on it, and it was really very impressive that the Security Council members were having a positive shift toward the perception of young people.
What is that positive shift?
The positive shift is that yesterday there were over 70 member states of the UN who signed up for the opening debate, and they were really appreciating the role of young people in promotion of peace globally. And they also understand the fact that the young people have always been frustrated by the fact that they are most often viewed as a problem to be solved rather than a partners for peace.
What is your takeaway from this meeting when you go back to South Sudan? What are you taking away?
The takeaway from this meeting is that the young South Sudanese will be able to realize that finally they have been recognized, that they are not only a problem to be solved, but they are agents of peace and conflict resolution within South Sudan. I think as a young South Sudanese, I will be able to use this resolution as a tool to lobby for inclusion of more young people in the grassroots level and in the ongoing peace process as well.
But the last time I checked on you, it appears like you fled South Sudan because your life was in danger. How are you going to implement this beautiful idea when you're not able to go home?
I think the way that I am able to implement this beautiful idea is that the South Sudanese are not only in the country. For example, now I'm in a neighboring country and I'm working with interesting South Sudanese young peace builders who are really advocating for peaceful coexistence of all South Sudanese. So we will be able to use it. And we have youth strategy meetings, not only in South Sudan, because even the youth who are in South Sudan, I understand that their life is most often in danger. There are a lot of, you know, issues. Sometimes the meetings are stormed down by the security.
What about ethnic polarization in South Sudan? Most of the people who have gone there who are independent-minded, who are not South Sudanese, have concluded that the youth in South Sudan are polarized along ethnic lines. How are you going to implement this UN resolution in a camp divided along ethnic lines?
Well, it's true that there is ethnic polarization within the South Sudanese communities. But the good news is, finally, the young South Sudanese have realized that they are only being used by the politicians as a means to achieve their own political ambitions. And when we understand that, we will be working so hard even to change our own mindset as a young South Sudanese. I will start it from myself, change my own mindset and reach out to my friend and reach out to all South Sudanese to understand that these ethnic tools is only used by our greedy politicians because they lack political ideology to convince citizens to support them. They rather resort to tribalism as a tool for their own political mobilization. And I understand that even right now, most South Sudanese young people have realized that, and that's why you see that we have often been coming together as a young South Sudanese to speak with one voice.
That's Malwal Bol Kir, co-founder of Africa Youth Network. He was speaking with me earlier today from New York. A spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross says the organization has suspended services in Lair County after its compound came under attack earlier this month. Aid agencies have confirmed reports of continued fighting between government forces and rebels loyal to Riek Machar in the former Unity State. Nabil Biagio has more for VOA from Juba.
Marie Motwit says the attack by what she calls unknown armed men 2 weeks ago on the ICRC compound violates international humanitarian law and the cessation of hostilities agreement both warring parties signed in December.
Armed men, they went outside our compound around midnight and they shot fire inside the compound. There were 8 staff members of the ICRC sleeping when this happened, and one of the shots that were fired also hit the leg of one of the security guards that was there at the moment.
She says the ICRC evacuated 8 staff members from the area and suspended its operations in Lear.
We had to postpone the ongoing distributions of seeds and farming tools that was going on at the moment when this happened. This was a distribution meant to benefit 24,600 people. At the time, we had distributed already to 8,600, but unfortunately 16,000 people are still remaining.
The ICRC was distributing free seeds and farming tools to families in Lear so that they could plant their crops ahead of the rainy season. Lear is one of 2 areas in which the United Nations declared a famine last year. It's one of the hardest hit areas of South Sudan's 5-year-long conflict. Motwit says the ICRC has been airlifting soldiers injured in the latest fighting in and around Lear.
We are continuing our efforts to help the people in the region in the former Unity States. Part of the mandate of the ICRC is to evacuate war wounded from wherever they are in the country. We do this by either helicopter or airplanes, and we bring them for surgical treatment in 4 different areas of the country.
The ICRC spokesperson says targeting aid workers violates international humanitarian law.
It's really heartbreaking when something like this happens because an attack on the ICRC is not just an attack on us, it's also an attack on the people that we are there to assist, because we have to cancel and postpone our activities when we are targeted. And this frightens us, it shocks us.
She says security conditions for humanitarian workers have deteriorated in recent weeks in former Unity State. Motwit says the ICRC is talking to armed groups in the area to get assurances that aid agencies will not be targeted once they resume operations. A spokesman for the government and rebels led by former Vice President Riek Machar confirmed the clashes took place, but accused each other of violating the signed ceasefire. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
The United Kingdom has pledged 70 million British pounds, the equivalent of $97 million, to help improve girls' education in South Sudan. Jonglei state officials say the money will help increase girls' enrollment and improve their performances in schools. Deng Gai Deng has the story for VOA from Bor.
Education officials and school administrators are meeting in Bor today to evaluate the impact of the UK-funded non-profit Girls Education South Sudan, or GES. Hannah Rowling is the project's communications officer.
We know that quality of education is very important, and it's something that we want to improve in the next phase of the program, because so we want to roll this out to more teachers, hopefully. And we really want to continue working together with the state ministry to improve accountability in schools.
The project, which began in 2014, provides cash transfers to girls in primary and secondary schools. Each girl receives 2,300 South Sudanese pounds per term to meet their personal needs, including buying sanitary pads. Rawlings says since the program started, the number of girls enrolled in school and staying in schools has risen.
We've been speaking to girls here today who came from a number of schools around Bor, and they've received the cash transfer. And it's really encouraging to hear from them that it's helped them to stay in school. You know, they've been able to buy these scholastic materials, even pay for school fees, and it's really been helping them stay in school.
The project also trained teachers. Jacob Ajuong teaches at Bor A Primary School.
We benefited a lot, like you make the scheme of work and the lesson plan plus the classroom management. And these are the things that we have gained as teachers.
Ajit Solomon Awan teaches at Alliance High School. He says the number of girls dropping out of school has fallen since the cash transfers program started.
There are certain things girls do need, and if they are not provided, it will actually force them at least to quit their school. But if all those needs are provided, like what the guest is doing by giving some CTF, which actually give them to have hygienical things, the collecting material, and even some could even actually try to pay part of their school fees.
Jonglei State Education Minister Ayom Mach praised the non-profit Girls Education South Sudan for supporting education program in Jonglei State.
Before the girls project, the number of girls in Jonglei State were low. But with the presence of the girls project, the number of girls increased and their performance also increased well. For example, in the last South Sudan primary certificate examinations, in Dongley State here, we had 328 girls, and about 322 passed. Only 6 girls failed. This is very encouraging.
March says last year the number of girls graduating from primary 8 in Dongley State rose to 300 compared to only 200 in 2016, due in part to the cash transfers. But Mike says there are still too many girls leaving school early.
The girls who are receiving the cash transfers, they are still being married. And the parents accept their marriages, and then they are married without the knowledge of the schools, without the knowledge of the State Ministry of Education. And later on, we find that the girl is already in her house, where we have nothing to say again. The learning environment is not conducive. It's not good. Because of the destruction of 2013 in terms of infrastructure, the government of the state has no that ability to construct schools now.
The minister says at least 17 primary schools in Jonglei State have closed because their buildings and facilities are dilapidated. He says the state government lacks the funds needed to renovate the schools. For VOA News, I am Deng Gaideng in Bor.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, recent progress made on fighting malaria is facing challenges. Find out why when we come back after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what's your biggest weakness?
I like to see the best in people. It's like if someone comes to me and says this person's like a very bad person, I won't believe it. I like to see the best in everyone.
My biggest weakness is being shy. I'm always shy when it comes to maybe strangers. When I don't get used to people a lot, that's the big problem.
I think I'm lazy, and I see it as my biggest weakness. This is because I don't like doing so many things at once.
It's to the other gender, women.
I'm easily provoked, you know, sometimes when
someone does something wrong to me, then it makes me feel bad or it makes me feel angry.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. It's time for our Tuesday health segment, and today we are talking about efforts to combat the spread of malaria. After 16 years of steady decline, malaria cases are on the rise again globally. Experts warn that unless efforts to tackle the disease are stepped up, the gains could be lost. Henry Ridgewell reports from a malaria summit in London where delegates called for a boost in funding for global anti-malaria programs.
Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates has invested billions of dollars into tackling malaria. It has paid off. Deaths from the disease fell by more than 60% between 2000 and 2015, meaning 7 million lives were saved. In 2016, however, that trend was reversed. There were more than 216 million reported cases in 91 countries, an increase of 5 million from the previous year.
The co-chair of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Mr. Bill Gates.
On the sidelines of this week's London Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting, Gates told delegates, including several African leaders, the fight against malaria must be stepped up.
If we don't keep innovating, we will go backwards. If we don't maintain the commitments that we're making here today, malaria would go back up and kill over a million children a year because the drugs and the insecticides always are evaded by the mosquito and the parasite.
Malaria is estimated to cost the African economy more than $12 billion per year and consumes up to 40% of national healthcare budgets on the continent. Children and pregnant women are most severely affected. The increase in cases is caused by a number of factors, Professor Alistair Craig of the University of Liverpool's School of Tropical Medicine said via Skype.
We're seeing quite dramatic increases in the resistance to the insecticides that we use to control the insect vector populations, and that has been really the mainstay of the gains and very remarkable gains that we've seen over the last few years. And we're just beginning to see that the parasites are starting to develop resistance to the drugs that we use to treat them.
Craig adds the fight against malaria will likely become harder.
And we've gained what might be called the easier gains, and now we've got the harder ones to do, and they take even greater implementation and newer tools to allow us to look at where transmission is taking place.
Such new tools cost money, but funding has plateaued. At the Commonwealth Conference, Britain pledged more than $2 billion to fight the disease, while Bill Gates put forward another $1 billion and urged the international community to do more. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The onset of conflict in South Sudan has led to a near collapse of the country's healthcare system. That's according to a new report that is accusing both government and rebel forces of directly attacking medical facilities and personnel as a target of war. Ayen Dengbior has the details from Washington.
New York-based Watchlist says between January 2016 and December 2017, researchers documented at least 50 attacks on medical facilities and personnel, and at least 750 denials of humanitarian access. These incidences occurred widely, according to report author Christine Monahan, who says even humanitarian flights had to undergo restrictions.
The SPLA, in some cases the SPLA-IO, were charging hundreds or thousands of dollars simply to land the plane and unload humanitarian goods. And then we also heard about what were called sitting fees. So these same humanitarian organizations had to each pay a couple hundred dollars to meet with SPLA leaders and then also SPLA-IO leaders to negotiate the release of humanitarian goods from the towns that they were flown into to areas outside of the towns where civilians were residing.
Researchers spoke to people in Greater Upper Nile, Bahr Ghazal, and Equatoria during the reporting period. They also interviewed more than 90 people, including South Sudanese refugees. Watchlist says forces used arson to destroy or damage medical facilities. In other cases, they occupied medical facilities and threatened, intimidated, detained, abducted, and even killed medical personnel and humanitarian workers. The report also says forces shot at ambulances and looted humanitarian convoys. It says soldiers also detained, extorted, or denied passage at checkpoints to aid workers. SPLA spokesman Lul Roy Kwong cannot be immediately reached for comment. Government spokesman Michael McQuay dismissed the report's findings.
These are false reports. If they are true, why is the report of 2016 being released at this time? These are cook reports so that they serve the interests of others.
For his part, SPLA-IO spokesman Lampal Gabriel put the blame on the government.
If we are provoked, we only go to the barracks. We hit the government in the barracks. We don't go to better places where civilians are or maybe where health facilities are. When we go and attack, the problem is when we leave or we retreat, the government come and do.
While researchers documented 50 attacks on medical facilities during the reporting period, Monahan says that number could be significantly higher. And the consequence of these attacks is felt by the country's most vulnerable.
You know, you really see a sharp rise in the spread of preventable diseases. And you see the rise of things like cholera and famine almost become themselves used as weapons of war, because if you deny civilians access to clean water, access to shelter, access to food, those are going to be some of the resultant consequences. And it becomes almost a deliberate tactic the parties to the conflict are using.
Monahan says individual UN member states have a responsibility to curb attacks on humanitarians.
You have a government and essentially the military arm of the government, the SPLA, which is one of the primary perpetrators of attacks and denials. You also have about 15 UN member state donor governments that are providing both humanitarian and development funding on a routine basis to the government of South Sudan. So part of what we have recommended in the report is certainly not for any of these member states to withhold humanitarian funding, but to use their status as a donor, particularly for development and reconstruction funding, to engage with the government for future development and reconstruction funding to continue to be provided. There needs to be improved security and improved access to civilian populations to deliver humanitarian aid.
The report recommends the UN establish a commission of inquiry to investigate the attacks and urges the UN Security Council to consider adding perpetrators to its sanctions list. Ayan Deng Bure, VOA News, Washington.
Authorities in Tamura State are accusing a group of armed men of abducting a dozen civilians from Namtina Payam last week. Tambora State Information Minister claims the armed group forced hundreds of residents to flee into the bush. Gift Friday has more for VOA from Kampala.
Information Minister Anikumbo says the Tambora State noticed presence of an armed group led by James Nando along the borders of the state over the past few weeks. The minister claims the armed youth are members of the SPLM-IO, loyal to the former Vice President Riek Machar. In an exclusive interview with South Sudan in Focus, Anikumbo says the group was stationed in Namutina Payam for a week, then withdrew without causing any trouble, but then abducted 12 people, including police officer, in the village of Namutina.
The good news is that most of those who were abducted have been able to make it back safely without any harming. All those who have escaped say they have done nothing to them but accept carrying for them their goods.
Anikumbo says the state government is willing to talk to the armed youth to address their grievances peacefully.
We as government, we are encouraging peaceful means of settling any dispute. And our brothers in the bush, we deferred in ideas of governance and they took to the bush. So we are advising that this is our people. If they're in the bush, they're fighting for the same people. So we advise that they don't mistreat our people.
The information minister says since the abductions, the state government deployed an unspecified number of security forces to protect the citizens and their properties.
Our gallant forces are just ready any day if there is any attack or any insurgency from the rebels. We will definitely respond.
Police officer Robert John says he was abducted last week from Namtina Payam. He's speaking in Arabic. He claims,
they took my gun and uniforms. I will go and report to the government. I will not leave my work because I was abducted from my workplace. If I wanted to leave the work, I would have not come back.
Namutina Payam administrator Alphonse Dinia says he was unable to relay critical information about the presence of rebels in the state to the government headquarters in Tombora because rebels allegedly stole the VHF long-range radio equipment.
After they went away, report came from the chief and some elders. They made a robbery raping on about two women. That is aside from the town here. They got them, came there directly to the dispensary, went into the radio room and collected the radio, plus all the elements.
SPLA-IO spokesman Colonel Lam Gabre refutes Ankumbo's allegations. He says the SPLA-IO only knows Alfred Fuchio in Western Equatoria.
That name is also his new one. Who we know there as person who is affiliated was always general is Alfred Fuchio. Currently is not in Western Equatoria or in Tumbura, is very far from that area. So Alfred Fuchio, at the moment, we don't have anyone operating around Tumbura or Yambio. Whoever is there, I'm not denying whether Mande is with us or not, but the truth is that the HPLA-IO have got a policy of not harassing civilian or abducting or causing all this kind of atrocities. We don't have that policy, and we don't allow it.
Colonel Gabriel says whatever James Nando is doing in Tumbura is on his own and not affiliated with the SPLA-IO. Some of the audio used in this story was recorded by Alex Daniel Digi, the press secretary of Najero County Authority. Gift Friday for VOA News, Kampala.
That's our show for this Tuesday. We now take you to Yambio with the song Tong Tong by Sweet J. We have been listening to Sweet J singing in her native Zande language about Tong Tong. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for making us part of your evening. We'd like to know what you think about this show. Our email is southsudan@voanews.com. You can also find us on Facebook. Our Facebook name is South Sudan in Focus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.